So we're probably all pretty familiar by now with hearing in a guided meditation the instruction, when your mind wanders. And it's usually pretty simple, and it usually has a couple of recurring themes. When your mind wanders, gently return your attention to the breath, and sometimes they'll add, without judging. And of course, our mind always wanders, and that's a truth that is sometimes ignored in the meditation guidance. So it's not bad advice, but I've been thinking about this, and I think that we actually miss an opportunity when we do this, because this is actually an opportunity, I think, to ask, what can we learn about our minds here? How can we deepen our practice? After all, learning how the mind works is a valuable assistance on our path. And all of this is sort of assistance to meditation, which is the bottom line is we all want to become enlightened. But of course, a more immediate goal, one that's more perhaps reasonable, and we could certainly see short-term results, is how to cause less suffering, how to have less suffering. Meditation is a tool that enables us to move forward in that direction. So I've got some suggestions for what to do when your mind has wandered. Now, I'm not recommending that you do all of these all the time, because after all, that's not really itself meditation, but an aid to meditation. So one thing I like to sometimes do is notice what the mind was doing, how it wandered. I mean, sometimes you'll be obsessing about a situation at home or at work, and you'll just find it keeps on gravitating, your attention keeps gravitating back to it like planets going into a black hole. But sometimes you'll just find that you've been wandering around in a primary process, one thought setting off another in a loosely related chain, and suddenly you realize that for some reason you're thinking about train schedules in Pondicherry. How did I get here? And it's sometimes can be a source of humor. Just noticing how the mind wandered is like watching a backyard full of puppies. So I think especially notice how the mind is drawn away from the breath. Then another thing that we can do is observe what happens when you do notice that you've lost contact with the breath. And I'm going to emphasize losing contact with the breath later, because I think that's, for me, a helpful way of thinking about it. But when you do notice, is there judgment? Are you a bad meditator? I was stuck for years being a bad meditator. I really thought I was a bad meditator, and everybody else was a much better meditator. And I still don't know why I stuck with it, but I did. I'm glad I did. So this is something that we can really get trapped in, thinking that just this very natural function of mind makes us a bad meditator. So another question is, when you've lost contact with the breath, is when you notice that you've done so, is there a sense of relief? Well, there might be particularly a sense of relief if you've been obsessing about some nasty situation at work, but even in things that seem less charged, is there a sense of relief? Now, Ajahn Sumedho says that wherever there is thought, there is suffering. Do you find this to be true for you? You might not agree. I'm not sure I do. But I find often if I look closely at the thinking process, there is dukkha going on there. Another thing to look at is, what is your attitude towards the experience? What is your attitude towards your sit, towards your discovery that you've wandered off into the tall weeds? What is your mood about this? What's your underlying feeling? And this points to the third foundation, or I prefer the word establishment of mindfulness. We know about the four establishments of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta. And the third one I like to think of as sort of mood, as the wallpaper in the room of your mind, the setting. And of course, I find that it really helps in my meditation if I have a positive attitude, because when I have a positive attitude, the breath is more pleasant and it's a lot easier to follow the breath. But it's helpful just to notice what the mood is. And it's also an opportunity, this when your mind has wandered, it's an opportunity to examine our intention. What do we actually want to do? Sometimes our intention is not very strong. We sit down because we've been told to. Sometimes we sit down because we feel we ought to. And intention is a powerful mental tool and worth our consideration, very careful consideration. I mean, not in the middle of a sit. You don't want to consider things too much. You want to, sort of settle back down. Don't try to do all of these at once. You might want to start with one plan. That is, when your mind wanders, and it will, might as well admit it up front, okay? It's going to wander a lot. What will you do in this sit when your mind wanders? Maybe just noticing what your mood is, what your attitude is. How do you feel about how your mind having wandered, and how do you feel about coming back to the meditation process? What's your mood? That might be a reasonable inquiry for one particular sit. Again, don't try to do them all at once. You're just going to be finding yourself analyzing, thinking for the rest of the period. So there's another opportunity, and this is more about reflection after the meditation is over, or when you're sitting around eating your granola. What can we learn about attention? Now, an aside here, talking about mental processes is kind of difficult. We don't have an established vocabulary. We were at an awareness retreat a few years ago, and we got lots of printed quotes on the topic. I have them somewhere. They're wonderful, wonderful things. But the teachers in the retreat were using consciousness and awareness in very specific ways, but the sources that were being quoted were using them interchangeably, even though they were talking about different concepts. So it made it very confusing keeping track of what was consciousness and what was awareness. Fortunately, I think we have a better understanding of when we talk about awareness and we talk about attention, it's fairly clear what I mean, but I will go into detail anyway, because at any moment in our mind, there are two processes going on. This is, of course, a huge oversimplification, but this is useful, at least I think, in terms of meditation. The two processes going on in our minds are attention and awareness. Awareness is sometimes called peripheral awareness, but I think this is kind of redundant. This is the broad field of physical and mental events that we are aware of without being particularly focused on any of them. So in the meditation, I brought this up as sort of the background stuff going on that a lot of it you don't notice, and a lot you do notice, but very, very slightly. Things in the field of vision, sounds going on, stuff that we often map out completely, especially if we're really focused on something. We tend to close out some of the stuff that's going on in this periphery. Now, attention is where we direct our focus on one particular phenomenon in that broad field of awareness. That's a little more complicated than that, because what's happening is our attention continually scans our field of awareness for anything important. Attention is analytical, it's judgmental, and it's self-oriented. There's a lot of what's in it for me. Awareness is non-judgmental and has very little thought process. It has very little self-involvement. So, how did this come to be? Well, think about Lucy. I love to talk about Lucy, an early hominid walking in the savanna in what's now sub-Saharan Africa. She's aware of the breeze, the waving of the grasses, the clouds, the smell of earth. She notices all these things, but she's not paying a whole lot of attention to them. She's probably focused on avoiding stubbing her toes as she walks along. Now, Lucy notices ripe berries over to her left. Now her attention is focused quite sharply on those berries, how they might taste, how to get to them. But then suddenly she hears the grunt of a nearby lion. Her attention, forget the berries, forget everything else. Her attention is focused on the situation. Can she run? Is there a tree to climb? The breeze and the clouds are not very noticeable at all. They're gone. She's focused on dealing with lion. So attention and awareness are interrelated. So imagine, if you will, carrying a full bowl of soup across a crowded dining room, like the dining hall at Spirit Rock. Your attention is on the soup and not spilling it, and you're really focused on that soup. But you're still aware of the room because you want to avoid bumping into a table or spilling your soup on somebody. So this is what attention, how attention and awareness are related. This attention is continually scanning the awareness for something that's important, whatever important might mean, something for our sustenance or survival or reproduction. That's always the good stuff. So the question sometimes might come up, are these two aspects of one phenomenon? And it turns out, surprisingly, or maybe not, that brain scans show that quite different areas light up for awareness and for attention. These are really two different processes going on. They're related strongly, but they're two different processes. Attention continually scans awareness for anything of interest. So you can see from my Lucy example how important this was to our survival as a species. Now, the attention moves around in our awareness so fast that a lot of what we touch on, it's like a spotlight. A lot of what we touch on may seem like it's just part of the background, but we touch on it so quickly and then move on, because a lot of the stuff is of very minor or no interest at all. Or, you know, it's so, like somebody shouts on the other side of the street. Your attention goes there very briefly and then back again, because there's lots of noise on the street. So people have different balances between how strong the attention is focused and how broad the awareness is, the peripheral awareness. And of course, these can change too. Think of a small social group out in the savannah, a social group of which Lucy is a part. A small social group would have much better survival odds if there were members who were really good at attention-focused tasks like chiseling rocks to make stone tools. And the group would also benefit from awareness-focused members who were alert to dangers and to help in foraging for food. So you can see how both qualities would be important from an evolutionary standpoint for the survival of the group as a whole. And we are social beings, we're social animals. And of course, it can change a lot in a person as well. We all know about people who get really involved in one particular task. I know people who, if they're doing computer programming, the house could burn down and they wouldn't notice. And other people who just seem to be really, you know, you think of them as being spaced out, and yet they're very aware in a sense of what's going on in a very broad loose way. Something else I ran across recently, which is related, is that in the Scientific American, there's an article in the next to last issue about two styles of problem solving. They're obviously related. One style is close attention, which is good for careful, stepwise analysis, breaking apart a problem into subproblems, which is great for computer programming, to get back to computer programming, where it takes a certain level of intense focus over a period of time. But then there's also awareness, where there's a broad receptivity, which promotes subconscious processing. or what we call intuition. We've all had experience of where we're doing a crossword puzzle and there's a word that we're thinking of and we can't quite get the word. And then later on, we'll be walking into the kitchen, the word pops into our mind when we're no longer trying to retrieve it. So there's the subconscious processing where the awareness is broad, like in dreaming, is much like that. There's a story of Kekulé. Some of you know this story. Kekulé was a chemist in the 1860s who was working on a problem of figuring out benzene. At the time, it was known that there were these long hydrocarbon chains, carbon atoms linked together in chains with hydrogen atoms sort of tacked on the side. And when you see octane ratings for gasoline today, that's just a measure of how much of that gasoline is made up of chains of eight carbon atoms in a row. That stuff burns fairly cleanly, so that's high-rated clean stuff. Benzene has six carbon atoms, but it's missing two hydrogen atoms that ought to be there. And chemists in the 18 middle of the 19 of the 1800s were really baffled by this. Kekulé had a dream in which he saw a dragon, or a snake rather, biting its tail, and he realized that benzene is a circle. So where those two hydrogen atoms would be bonded were where the two carbon atoms joined hands, as it were, to form a circle. So that may be kind of too nerdy an example, but he found the example, he found the solution in a dream. I once solved a computer programming problem in a dream. I knew I had a solution, but I couldn't quite figure out the shape of the solution. I won't go into details. I already blew it with the Kekulé's dream business. But the answer came to me in a dream, and I woke up and I realized immediately that it was the correct answer. Went in, and in about an hour, I programmed it. So I want to say that this attention and awareness dichotomy is a huge oversimplification. I know it's really not that tidy. I'm only hoping that this sketchy outline might be useful. I haven't even touched on emotion, a whole other dimension of our mental processes, or on meta practice, which is something that I love and I think hugely important. Habituation, of course, is a part of that. I barely touched on the role of intention, which is also related to habituation, to developing patterns that we can return to in a reliable way. And attention itself also breaks down into two components, our old friends vitakka and vichara. You remember Philip Moffat gave a talk many years ago on a whole hour on vitakka and vichara, or as he translates it, aim and sustain. Vitakka is placing the attention somewhere, and vichara is sustaining the attention there. It turns out, by the way, that these also show remarkably different brain activity patterns. So, how does this attention and awareness stuff affect our meditation practice? This phenomenon of the attention scanning awareness for significant information is not under our direct conscious control. So, when we sit down and we try to stay with the breath and the mind wanders, it's not your fault. Or, as Wes Nisker says, you are not your fault. Your wandering mind is not your fault. You can't really do anything about it. Over time, you can maybe change, but you can't really direct your attention effectively. In fact, there's no you that could direct the attention. When you think about it, if there were veering into the whole area of anatta or not self, if there was a self, that self would be the boss and would say, "All right, attention, you stay there." And the attention would do it. But there's no control panel, and there's nobody at the control panel. And there's not a lot of time tonight to dig into this a lot deeper, but it's like a committee without a chairperson. It's various processes vying for centrality. It's like a circus cage full of monkeys arguing with each other and occasionally hurling feces. And there's nobody at the control panel, and in fact, there is no control panel. So accepting this can actually take a lot of pressure off our practice. We just do the best we can. And sometimes our best just isn't very good. Other times it's pretty good, but we do the best we can with what we've got, with some semblance of what passes for self at any given moment. Our ability to meditate actually does improve with practice, but it's about using our intention to unify the various aspects of our mind. That is, our mind can become more unified. It's sort of like if it is a committee, the committee can sort of, with time, become more on the same page, as it were. So, another aspect of how this affects our meditation is that we often hear people talking about concentration practice or samatha practice versus mindfulness or wisdom practice. But that came later. The Buddha never split meditation into two different styles of meditation. He did describe it in different ways, but he never talked about it being two different practices. It can be useful sometimes to think about it as different practices, but we can easily get bogged down into something. For many people, mindfulness practice is really sort of serial concentration practice. We focus on something, whatever is coming up, we'll focus on that for a while. And then when it becomes less interesting, we'll go back to the breath. So it's sort of like serial concentration practice, often as it's taught. Not everybody does that. And concentration practice often is taught, and less so now, but when I started meditating, concentration practice was you got to really glue yourself to the breath. It's like duct tape yourself to the breath. And I found that really difficult. It produced a lot of conflict because you stick yourself to the breath, and then when your mind wanders, which it's going to do, it's sort of like, oh my God, I wandered off the breath. Pull it, yank it back like a dog on a leash, and then stick your attention back on the breath. And what you got is wandering mind and conflict. So the conflict is optional. The wandering mind is not. The conflict is optional. So when people started encouraging relaxed attention in concentration retreats, I found that enormously helpful, that my unification of mind really helped a lot. Personally, I've been working to develop both attention and awareness. And I realized only recently that this was basically what I had been doing. Because I found one helpful model, one helpful metaphor was to focus on the breath. See if you could keep the breath sort of in the middle of your awareness, almost like you've got crosshairs on it. I mean, I hate crosshairs because that's like a sniper scope. It's a hunting metaphor, and I'm not into hunting. But can you keep the breath sort of in the middle of things and just allow everything else to be around? Physical sensations, sounds, thoughts. Don't try to make them go away. They won't. And you'll just get frustrated if you try to make them go away. Or I've been doing more of, can I just sustain a relationship with the breath, no matter how tenuous? If the breath is part of my experience, then I'm finding that I still am moving towards a greater unification of mind, a settling down, a calming, a serenity. So that's why in the guided sit, I said, can you encourage people to say, can you sustain a relationship with the breath no matter how tenuous? I have found that very helpful. So I often meditate with a form of choiceless awareness, and I like to call it catch and release. I start with open, relaxed attention. And I try to open to the vastness of awareness as if it's a big, empty space with a lot of stuff happening in it. But the space itself is quite large, plenty of room for all those things that happen on the periphery. And I don't try to suppress any content. As I like to say, everything all at once, but nothing in particular. Everything all at once, but nothing in particular. So all that stuff, but not trying to single out. And of course, the attention is still flitting around. That's going to happen. So notice that I notice the attention is scanning like a spotlight. And when it finds something, a physical sensation or a sound or a thought, I notice it. And it's big in my attention very briefly. Then I let it go. Because then the attention goes back to scanning. Find something else, notice it, let it go. So it's acknowledging that the attention is there. It's not going to go away. Don't want it to go away. It's very useful. And I try all of that to sustain a relationship to the breath, and I find it very calming. And as we practice, our attention helps unify our mind and strengthen both functions, the attention and the awareness. It's not like you have to develop one at the expense of the other. They both get stronger as the mind gets more unified and the mind gets more, I hate to use the word powerful, but I think that's, for want of a better word, it'll have to do. The jhana factor, ekagata, is often called single-pointedness, which sounds very squished and narrow. But Ajahn Sumedho likes to say that it's the one point that contains everything. And I like, I think a better definition of ekagata is not single-pointedness, but unification of mind. Unification of mind is possible generally on longer meditation retreats, but it's a wonderful experience. So to recap, just as bring this back to meditation practice, notice how your attention and awareness interact. The wandering of mind in attempted meditation is a great way to do that. So when you notice that your mind has wandered, just seriously notice what happens when your mind is wandered. What can you learn from it? Where can you go with that? So we have a much shorter talk than I had thought when I wrote my notes. So we've got loads of time for questions, observations, jokes, whatever. So it helps if you raise your hand. There's a raise hand icon somewhere along the bottom of the Zoom window when you move your mouse around. You can also raise your hand physically if you can't find that. Deborah, I see your physical hand raised. So I knew you were going to do that. So.
Well, first of all, thank you. That was fabulous. And I had to laugh and smile because I submitted a quote for the newsletter that maybe will make it into the newsletter next time. And I can't even remember who said the quote. I can't remember who I was quoting. But it said exactly what you were talking about, in part, that when we realize that our mind has wandered, to be happy. Because that means we're being mindful. So the fact that I was reading and rereading that quote recently, and then you talked in part about that, and I love the distinction that you made. So once again, Bill, you hit it out of the park, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Deborah. Yeah, I should have more explicitly said that happiness is a very good response for when your mind is wandered, especially when you finally get away from being judgmental about it and being a bad meditator. You've had an insight. When you realize that your mind is wandered, you've had an insight. There should there there it it's nice to cultivate this as an aha moment and enjoy it. So, Zoe.
I love this talk too, Bill. In a way, it's bringing it maybe a little bit back to basics, but where in a sense everything is, it's really the important part of meditation to understand, what to do with your mind when it's all over the place. And I love hearing you talk about, not so being so concerned about sticking with the breath, but allowing the wider field of consciousness and being able to kind of the interplay with awareness and attention, which to me is that the bigger field and then back to the breath and how those two things work together. That you mentioned insight for what Deborah was noticing, and that's the question that sort of popped into my head. If taking from this starting point of attention, focusing on attention and awareness, how do you use that if you are in the context of developing insight in your practice? Where does it go from there, in a sense?
Well, you can place your attention in a number of different ways. I talked about sort of returning to the breath, but of course, you can place your attention on other phenomena. Like, for instance, if you're having trouble, pain in your knee, you can make that the object of your attention and see if you can sustain a relationship with that pain and get away from the second arrow aspect of the knee pain. That is, what are the actual sensations going on in the knee rather than your fears about the knee or your images of the knee? Now, longer term, I think a stronger sense of awareness also means a stronger sense of what we would call intuitive knowing. So I think that's where insight can arise more naturally. We're actually opening up more space for wisdom to arise spontaneously when we strengthen our relationship with that peripheral awareness as well as with the attention. They go together, so we can't, it gets a little weird if you try to cultivate one at the cost of another. The other thing is that when you know about attention and awareness, just when you ride BART to work, or when you're at a boring meeting at work, say, or at some family dinner, you can also notice how your attention is moving around in that field of awareness. And it can be an interesting way of noticing what's drawing you and what isn't. And if not, it's a good way to pass the time in an otherwise boring situation. So you're likely to learn something if you are noticing that interplay between attention and awareness at any time, on the cushion or not. Liz.
Thanks for a really wonderful talk. I'm a bit of a heretic on the topic of self, and I'm a self person, 65 years of therapy. I am just at 86, beginning to really think about the self and willing to open it up and to make it more porous. You gave a quote from Wes Nisker, "You are not your fault," but you left out the second part, "But you are your responsibility,"
Yes.
which is change. This quote changed my life, let me tell you. Extraordinarily, it just hit me with a tremendously positive wallop. And so I'm exploring the notion of self. And I'm also, again, of an age where my ideas and my thoughts, my feelings, my concepts are maturing or changing. And I think this happens over time. I think what you were describing today was also, in a sense, a maturation process. I'm using that word advisedly. But when you look at the self, it's conditioned. It's formed by causes and conditions. I am looking at those causes and conditions right now in my life where I am, looking at dependent origination, looking at how my self is formed. And yet I want that self. I want that you are your responsibility. I want to call up the self when I'm making decisions, which may be wrong at the time, but I want a chief there. I want a manager. And that doesn't frighten me or offend me, as many Buddhists might. I celebrate the self. It's important for me. Thank you.
Well, the whole issue of self and not self is sort of beyond what we can address here. It's obviously a very interesting topic. I remember Ajahn Amaro once saying, yes, you might simply be a product of causes and conditions, but if a cop pulls you over, you don't tell him that. You show him your driver's license. There are times when, a self is very useful. Don't leave home without it. And we certainly have a strong sense of self. And a lot of Buddhism doesn't make sense without some kind of self involved, like, for instance, karma. We have volition. Volition leads to karma. And the karma doesn't make sense if there isn't something that carries the karma. Now, we could get into all kinds of arguments about that. One thing that's interesting about the nature of the self is that they've been doing all kinds of very interesting brain scans and tests, and they've discovered all kinds of things about, for instance, awareness versus attention and different kinds of attention, location of things like language, various activities. It's really quite extraordinary how they've been able to locate things. Now, they haven't been able to figure out a whole lot more than the location. They have not been able to figure out any kind of test or any kind of scan, and they've come up with some very clever tests. They've not been able to find anything that resembles self. So self is still a mystery, and yet we all know it when we see it, right? It's sort of like, I know who's brushing my teeth, and I know what happens if I don't brush my
Right.
teeth. So I think it's useful to have a self, but it's a great place for curiosity. What's happening? What happens when the self is torn, when you can't decide something? You might find that there is something like a committee going on, different selves debating what's going on. Think about it. Maybe that's not a useful metaphor for you, the corporate metaphor or the committee metaphor, but there might be some other metaphor that makes sense. But whatever it is, curiosity, again, I'm a big fan of curiosity as a spiritual
My
tool of
turn.
quest. So be curious about the self. Doesn't
Absolutely.
hurt, no matter what your attitude about the self is. I like the self too. I mean, I'm used to my personality. As Ajahn Sumedho says, the personality never gets enlightened, though. What does that mean?
I don't believe them.
Well,
Well,
maybe.
thank you very much. This is all a tremendous exploration and has changed radically for me as I got older. And gets more exciting and more interesting every day. And
Good.
I believe in, I don't know what other words to use, the maturation of the self.
The self
Maybe
certainly changes. And when you're as old as we are, you like to think it gets better.
it does. I think it
I
does.
think so. I think so
There's
too.
just so much more awareness of what we're doing. Thank you.
So, Patty.
Thank you, Bill. I love the talk and I love the comments. And I'm going to introduce a joke, but the joke is in memory of Anna Douglas, my first and favorite teacher. And she made this joke up. And I think of her all the time when we talk about self. So I'm going to tell the joke that Anna Douglas made up. And I love this joke. Dukkha, Anatta, and Anicca are walking down the street. And Dukkha sees her reflection in the store window and says, "Oh my goodness, I got so old. Look at me. I can't believe how old I got." And Anicca says, "Of course you look different. Every time you look, you're going to be different. We're changing all the time." And Anatta says, "Who are you two talking to?"
I like
So
that.
I
I
love
like
that
that.
joke. And I love that Anna Douglas created that joke, and I think of her when I tell it.
Really interesting.
Well, if I give another talk on Anatta, and I'm highly likely to, I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal that.
Philosophical discussion of attention and awareness. What's the difference, and how do we use them, and all kinds of stuff.
Well, my attention has always been a de deficit disorder. I have attention deficit.
All right, so that's interesting, Mary. I mean, Marion.
I didn't realize I was not muted, and
Oh
I
well.
talked to David about saying what a good talk it was.
Well, thank you. Your observations are interesting and welcome. So I'm going to go ahead and mute you and call on Mary Kelly because she's next here. Okay, Mary Kelly.
Yeah, Bill, thank you for the talk. So one of the things for me in meditation and just kind of how walking through life, because I mean meditation is all well and good. I think it's good, but really we want to bring the Dharma into our daily life. That's the Runsangha thing. And so it's really lovely when we can even, like you said, where what am I available to now? Like what's my awareness and where's my attention in any given moment, which I think is really, should I shut my mouth or should I not? Kind of questions. For me, one of the things that's really been helpful is this very visceral physical sense of inward dwelling. And I guess Dawn Scott and other people talked about kind of like that in back and down that I feel like really like where I'm coming from is like from within. I so much of my life impetuous, moving forward and just dropping back and being inside and really noticing that as the felt sense. That's one of the things I do when I start my meditation. And I think that for me, that's so helpful. So that, the breath is really good, but I can now use that sense of being within, and that actually has become kind of an anchor, which is a really good thing. And I can, it's almost kind of like what you said. There is spaciousness, awareness, and then an attention of, and where am I dwelling? And where am I moving from? Kind of like the citta, and using that in my formal meditation, and then just even when I'm taking a walk or whatever I'm doing, is can I drop back into that? And it is such an interesting play of the attention, intention, and awareness. So thank you so much for this talk. It was just a really lovely reminder. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. I think just being aware of the interplay between attention and awareness can be very helpful for, we're walking around and we see the berries or we hear the lion. How do we react? Metaphorically, of course. Anyone else? Oh, Barbara.
Yeah, just to go back to what you started with, talking about when your mind wanders. And I was thinking all along, but what are we doing here? The Buddha says we're supposed to be training the mind. So what does that mean? And there's a parallel, I think, with modern animal training, because it used to be you would punish the animal, now you give the animal treats. And I think when you're training the mind, when you get out of, when you're suddenly aware that your mind has been wandering, an insight to enjoy that treat that, whoa, I did something right. I or no I, it's a good feeling. And some of these other feelings that meditation can arise or arouse, like what Mary was talking about, an inward dwelling or a sense of well-being, just to be able to appreciate it, enjoy it, not to cling to it and grab on or try to create more of it, but just and then your mind wants to go back there. I found lately that's been very helpful for me because now I'm not punishing myself. I'm, oh, this is pleasant. I will meditate a little longer, or I will keep the mind steady. And it turns out that yes, the mind is steadier then.
Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, I find it very helpful at the beginning of a sit to try to cultivate a friendly attitude towards my experience. And I've talked here before about the beautiful breath. And one of the things that can happen with meditation is that it does become more pleasant, and that makes the meditation easier. And it also, I think, spills over into our life that we start to look at all of our experience with a friendlier attitude. So, Kylie.
Just quickly following on from what Barbara just said and that cultivating that friendly attitude, another of my beloved teachers described greeting her lost attention like a lost friend and saying, "Oh, there you are." When your attention returns from the myriad of lost thought, being lost in thought. And I really like that too, just that soft, gentle friendliness really helps.
I agree. Great observation. All right. Well, thanks everyone for your kind attention.